Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The trade associations connected to federal technology generally back the latest White House directives on artificial intelligence. A recent Office of Management and Budget memo gives agencies detailed guidance on making trustworthy and secure AI systems. For one view, we turn to the Executive Vice President for Policy at the Information Technology Industry Council, Gordon Bitko. Gordon, good to have you back.
Tom, great to be here as always.
And when you were a federal CIO, this whole artificial intelligence question really didn't come up. I mean, people knew it was out there, but it wasn't really something close to the toolbox for CIOs, was it?
It was not. I think what we've had is a real tipping point in computational ability that's made it much more available and accessible much more widely and readily today than it was. But as you know, Tom, the reality is a lot of what we're saying is AI now are things that we did talk about 4 or 5 years ago when I was in the government. A lot of the advanced machine learning capabilities, a lot of those tools were there already.
And the White House memos in the Biden administration have been lengthy and detailed, but there's a lot of detail that needs to be in there. Is there anything in ITI's view or in your experience that's fundamentally different about AI and how to build AI systems than any other kind of logic-based application using software?
That's a great question, Tom. To your initial point, there is an awful lot of specificity in the executive order, in the OMB guidance memo, beyond what I would say is the normal sort of guidance that would come out on a technology issue coming from the White House to agencies. The reality is that I think a lot of this is about the perceptions of risk associated with the use cases of AI that people have talked about and the fear about where the system's going to go and how reliable and how accurate are they. But the reality is, if you look at a lot of what the memo, the guidance to agencies expects out of this new role, the chief AI officer, it's no different than what chief information officers are supposed to be doing for agencies already. What's the inventory of all the technology you have? How is it being used? How are you managing the risks? How are you ensuring you have the right resources in place and prioritizing things? Those are all things that a CIO is supposed to be doing today.
And it sounds like in the case of AI, though, it's not strictly a CIO concern, because the rise of the data officer, which is somewhat separate from the CIO. In some cases, it's not even in the CIO channel. That varies from agency to agency. But the data issue is a big part of AI, because the data goes into the AI as opposed to the other traditional applications where they produce the data.
That's a great point, Tom. A couple of observations on that. One is, I think it's going to be confusing for agencies. They've got a chief data officer now, a chief AI officer, a chief privacy officer who's got responsibilities around a lot of these data concerns, a chief information officer, a chief information security officer, maybe a chief technology officer. And as you noted, sometimes they're co-located organizationally, sometimes they're not. Sometimes their priorities are well aligned with the overall mission. Sometimes they have different priorities because they report to different parts of the organization. That's going to be a really big challenge for agencies to figure out, number one. Number two, the point about the importance of data is absolutely critical here. Agencies have been slowly coming around to the importance of that for quite a while and making investments, but that's lagged. That's one of the reasons why I would hope that this will give the impetus to agencies to make investments that they need. There is a federal data strategy. They've been slowly working towards it, but it hasn't gotten the attention that it really should. And maybe this is a way to move that forward.
And maybe the memo didn't state this explicitly, but in some ways it kind of reflects the age-old idea that ultimately it's the program and the program manager, program owner, business line owner, that's ultimately responsible for what happens in that program, including the IT and whatever effects AI would have. Fair to say?
Absolutely. I think for the AI officers to be effective, they're going to have to be in this in-between space between the technologist, between the CIO, the CTO, the security, and the mission, the business people, and understanding that big picture for the AI use case. What is the mission? Why is this AI tool, data system going to help solve a problem for the agency in ways that we couldn't previously? They're going to have to serve in that bridge. And if they don't develop that understanding and expertise of the mission, they can't be successful.
We're speaking with Gordon Bitko, Executive Vice President of Policy at the Information Technology Industry Council. And then, of course, whatever agencies must do means contractors and companies are going to have to do it. And that's where it kind of runs downhill to the companies. What's your best advice for all of the integrators, the developers, the application providers, the cloud people that are going to be impacted because AI is so much in demand?
Well, the first thing I would say is that there is a recognition of that on the side of government. There is an RFI specifically looking about how do we do responsible procurement of AI for government needs. My hope is that the government realizes that the most responsible procurement that they can do is to work closely with industry, with the whole ecosystem you just mentioned, to say, we want to do this in a secure, reliable way, but using commercial best practices. Far too often, as we've talked about in the past, Tom, the government comes up with a long list of requirements for, I think, good reasons, but what you end up with then is building some custom one-off solution that's hard to maintain, hard to support, hard to modernize, and eventually you end up with a 20-year-old system that nobody really knows what to do with it anymore. I would really hate to see that happen in the case of AI. At the pace the technology is moving, the best thing that government industry can do is work together to get solutions in the hands of the people who need it.
It seems like a contractor that's going to be dealing with algorithms and delivering them almost has to have into its basic operating plan as a company the controls needed for AI rather than try to make a bespoke AI safety solution, let's put it, for each and every contract or task order.
That's right. We would really like to see, for example, the NIST AI risk management framework and guidance built around that be adopted broadly. And then government agencies can have confidence that the contractors that they're working with understand risk, understand the use cases for their technology, and are putting in place the things necessary to ensure that it's being done safely and securely, that the data that's being used to train the system are representative, that they're not biased. All those valid concerns, there are ways to follow them. One of the areas where I think the OMB memo goes a little bit astray is instead of saying follow that approach, they come out with a laundry list of here's all the things that they think are high risk.
Sure.
Undoubtedly, many of them are high risk, but the specifics of every use case are going to vary. And we would really rather say, let's use the risk management framework rather than have this other sort of prescriptive approach.
And can you envision a time when companies won't really be selling AI, just as agencies won't be buying AI? They'll simply be buying and selling contemporary applications, a component of which happens to be artificial intelligence.
That's already happening today, Tom. It's a great point. And one of the questions that we've had and one of the challenges, to give you an example, we have in the ITI membership a number of companies who provide security solutions in one way or another. A lot of the way that they build their models to understand security threats is using big data machine learning AI models that collect millions or billions of endpoint pieces of data about what are the threats and what are the activity, and they need sophisticated tools to help them understand, is this an indicator of a threat or not? And then they provide the results of that to the government, to customers who are using those products and services. That's going to happen more and more across the board, where people are going to want those capabilities. They're going to want that because the amount of data is too large otherwise to deal with. It's not the sort of thing that you can solve in other ways.
Sure. And just a final question on the talent base in industry and government. Is it sufficient to cover these needs so that everyone can act in a competent manner and still fulfill what OMB wants? And really what OMB wants is basic good practice and good hygiene for anyone using AI.
I think that's what they would call a leading question, right, Tom? We know when it comes to technology that there is never enough trained, skilled workforce across the board. There are individual agencies that are more technically inclined, that are operating from a higher starting point and probably in pretty good shape, but across the board, we need to invest in joint solutions between government and industry, between public and private partnerships to raise the overall skill level. And then I think a related point to that, Tom, is lots of job descriptions over time in the government and outside are going to evolve because people are going to want and need to take advantage of new tools. And so what does that mean? And what does that mean for retraining the existing workforce so that they know how to use those tools and become more effective and be more focused on the actual real things that we need them to do that can't be solved by AI, but really actually do need a person to be looking at something and making a decision.
Gordon Bitko is Executive Vice President of Policy at the Information Technology Industry Council, the ITI. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks again, Tom. Great to be with you.
And we'll post this interview along with a link to more information at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down, so I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So, for example, we're recruiting. what's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is, what do they need when they need it? And building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor and I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs. That's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well.
Thank you.
Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.